Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam. In one of the beautiful conversations of Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam, we find that he was speaking with one of his companions, and he told his companion an interesting thing about a way in which we please, satisfy, and make happy our enemy. Now, in the conversation, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam told his companion that he who follows his desires pleases his enemy. Now, what's really interesting here is that every single one of us has at least one enemy. And as the Holy Quran calls that enemy, the Adovum Mubin, the greatest enemy, that is, of course, Shaitan. Now, how can we please Shaitan? How do we make Shaitan happy? Well, one of the ways in which we do this is by following our desires. Now, of course, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam in this conversation is not talking about these positive desires, for example, where one wants to worship more or one wants to fast with sincerity. It's not these kind of desires. The kind of desires that are being spoken about are these lowly, base, carnal desires, these kind of fancies. And so here, of course, these kind of desires and fancies and base, lowly desires and lusts, if one ends up following them, if one ends up obeying them, if one ends up falling under the command of these things, then surely we are making Shaitan happy. Because in reality, obeying our low desires and obeying our carnal desires and obeying these kind of lowly desires, of course, is in reality obeying Shaitan, because these things take us away from Allah, and the main goal of Shaitan is to take us away from the Almighty Allah. And of course, we find that when an individual begins to become obedient to their lowly desires, they end up becoming humiliated and degraded in society. This, of course, leads the enemies of an individual other than Shaitan. It leads these enemies of an individual to become happy, to become content, and to become pleased. And so, of course, in our daily lives, we must make sure to not follow our base desires, to try to find a way to control our lowly desires and our different fancies and whims and imaginations, as it is said, and all in order for us to be able to control ourselves, live a better life, of course, not make our greatest enemy, Shaitan, happy, and all in all, it will help us to gain nearness to the Almighty Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. Basically, look at the special wisdom that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to our ninth Imam. What is zinat? Beauty. We even had a marriage. You know, we hear many times, Inna Allah jamilun yuhibbul Jamal. Allah is beautiful and He loves beauty. And we hear it mostly in the context of marriage ceremonies. But we do realize that, you know, when we talk about the Jamal of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that He is Jamil and He likes Jamal, it's not really about physical beauty. Especially in the marriage ceremony and in the context of marriage, you know, the beauty is actually in the eyes of the beholder. For every groom, the wife, the bride is the Zulaikha, and for her, that's her Yusuf. You know, so but we had to realize that when we talk about zenith and beauty and jamal, from the Islamic perspective, when you look at the Quran and the ahadith of the Masumeen, this concept transcends, you know, physical realm. It covers our moral and ethical dimension also, and it even reaches to the level of spirituality. If you look at the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually talks about different dimensions of zenith when he talks about the earth itself. But let's go to the hadith of the Imam, where Imam talks about a zenith in a very different level. He's talking about the zenith in the character of a human being. Zenith in the akhlaq of a human being. There are about 12 to 15 issues that he talks about it. And he says, in all this situation that you might find yourself, you have to look for the element in that situation which can be zenith for you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Bringing currency volatility under control is the name of the game for the new governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, who is charged with getting a grip on the Iranian rial and devising new strategies to alleviate the country's economic woes amid unprecedented Western sanctions. And to do so, he has unveiled a new golden currency exchange center in an effort to regulate market fluctuations, or in his own words, stabilize market rates by adjusting demand and supply. But most importantly, as a powerful tool to control speculative inflation. For those familiar with Iran's economy, the most essential economic parameter that can effectively tip the scales.
We have enough resources to provide for all demands for exchange. The main challenge we are facing is speculative inflation as a consequence of negative forecasts, which leads to producers increasing the price of commodities and therefore creates a vicious circle. We need to overcome this challenge, and I'm calling on all those involved in economic activities to join hands with us and strictly follow the new policies of this newly launched center of exchange.
This means that all foreign exchange resources, notably from export, must be supervised by the central bank.
The 28,500 toman exchange rate for basic commodities and essential medicines still stands. Other demands for foreign currencies have been carefully categorized, and in the first leg, we are allocating $4 million to specific purposes, which include travel, studying abroad, and research projects, the details of which will be announced shortly.
This is actually a policy that has been successfully implemented by Russia and allowed the ruble to recover its value within a month after its initial plunge at the beginning of the Ukraine war.
Russia's success in implementing this policy is mostly due to their system of financial supervision, which ensures that regulatory rules are strictly observed. There are major differences between the economic and monetary structures and approaches of Iran and Russia. And if Iran wants to succeed, it has to take all this into account.
And the good news is, if this policy is successfully implemented, the recovery of the rial is imminent in a situation very similar to what happened in Russia.
Russia's national currency is gaining strength. The ruble is hitting new highs against the U.S. dollar. The Russian economy is making a turnaround despite unprecedented Western sanctions and pressure. Now Iran, taking Russia as a role model, is hoping to do the same. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
They said they were in it for the long haul, and they have kept their promise. Thousands of ambulance drivers from two separate unions walking off the job across much of England and Wales. Their demand, a pay award that keeps pace with the rising cost of living. The message, that the service is already stretched beyond its limit. Mondays are typically the busiest day for ambulance services across the country, with people now advised to use the 991 service only in an emergency. Despite the disruption, public support for the strikers is strong.
I live with two ambulance drivers and a nurse, so my answer is yes, they deserve more. I think they need more pay, yes.
We're very lucky the people that are working in the hospitals are nice enough to carry on working during the pandemic and not strike earlier, to be fair, because we needed them, they were there when we needed them, and when they need us, we're not there for them, sort of thing, so I think it's a shame.
Despite being on strikes, the crews still leave the picket lines to respond to emergency calls. But the message is, even serious calls will face substantial delays.
The strike action by NHS staff has only intensified in recent weeks, with multiple other walkouts planned for next month. Another single biggest day of action will be the beginning of March, when nurses will once again walk off the job, just like ambulance drivers are doing today.
The unions insist the solution is in the government's hands, a pay increase of about 10%. In the case of nurses, 5% above inflation, that's stubbornly in the double digits. Yet the man holding the strings to the public purse, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, says that's not affordable.
Government spend lots of money on other things, even NHS-wise, that needn't be spent, that could be paying the people that look after everybody, yeah.
February has already seen more than 500,000 people take industrial action. With public strike fatigue nowhere in sight, the walkouts are likely to continue for months. Saeed Purizam, London.
Bringing charm to the Iranian capital with some of the most beautiful Persian orchestra pieces and musical performances to jam-packed concert halls in Tehran. The most prestigious musical event in Iran is underway. The 38th Fajr International Music Festival opened in Tehran on February the 17th. While the capital is hosting over 30 music bands from across the country, foreign musicians have also found the opportunity to go on stage, including these Hungarian musicians. 7 concert halls in Tehran, as well as over 30 other arenas in 14 provinces, are hosting this year's event.
I am grateful to the musicians that took part in the festival this year. I would also like to take the opportunity to tell you that we have added some awards to our list, and other than the Barbat Prize for the Best Music Album, as of this year, we will also have the Best Song, Lyrics and Media Awards.
Over 2,000 musicians are taking part, either in the competitive Barbat Prize section or the non-competitive pop, traditional, and orchestral music sections. What has made this year's event even more special is the performance of the Iranian Police Force Music Band.
It was an honor to perform in the Fajr Music Festival, and I'm glad that military bands now also have a place in this prestigious event. I hope that more bands take part in the future.
But still, as always, the traditional and folk music sections are under the spotlight, adding glitz and glamour to the name Fajr, which means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year.
Kisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The German city of Munich hosts a security conference every year to discuss global security challenges. The conference this year has been held against the backdrop of the Ukraine war. Berlin, one of Kiev's biggest arms suppliers, barred Moscow from the event. Also excluded from the list of invitees was Iran. In defiance of international norms, three notorious anti-Iran propagandists were invited. The three anti-Iran figures claim that they have achieved unity, along with several others, to campaign for international support in favor of what they call Iran's protest movement. They attended a meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference on Saturday. During the meeting, Reza Pahlavi, whose family name is synonymous with decades of oppression against the Iranian nation, pleaded with Western countries to work with what he called a different Iran. He said in this case, the West would have, in his words, a true ally. How can the son of deposed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi have forgotten how Iranian people toppled his father's U.S.-backed dynasty in favor of independence and freedom? While Iranians stood up against the monarchy in Iran some 40 years ago and succeeded in overthrowing it, Reza Pahlavi has refused to distance himself from what his father stood for. He likes being named as the son of Shah or Shahzadeh, which shows he has nothing to present rather than his infamous family background. Another anti-Iran figure who attended the meeting was Masih Alinejad, variously promoted as a journalist, activist, and dissident by Western media. Cashing in on the recent riots in Iran, she claimed that Iranians want regime change. Alinejad, who has been on U.S. government payroll for years, also urged the West to take strong action against the Islamic Republic. It's no surprise that a person funded by Washington has pinned all her hopes on Western powers. Since the riots broke out in Iran following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September, Alinejad has been lobbying for support from Washington and its allies. She has tried to depict the Islamic Republic as an establishment on the decline, citing those weeks of unrest. The riots, however, have since died down and Iran has managed to restore calm. Now it seems that even hardline leaders in the West are not buying into her claims. The three anti-Iran campaigners have also asked the West to exert maximum pressure on Iran and made no secret of their request. They should be reminded that the country has managed to neutralize the effects of Western sanctions and plots. Meanwhile, Iran has been forging strong bonds with multiple countries and become a member of significant cooperation organizations. Excluding Iran from international summits seemed to be in line with desperate efforts by the West to counter the country's growing regional and international power and influence. The participation of millions of Iranians in the 44th anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution is an indicator that foreign-backed elements have failed to achieve their goals.
Another scene of wide-scale destruction in Syria, this time signed by Israel.
Israeli fighter jets attacked multiple residential targets in Damascus, killing at least 5 people and injuring 15 others, with the majority being civilians.
All residents were sleeping in the building. This is a residential neighborhood. The missile landed here. A number of residents were killed and others injured. There are no officials or any prominent figures living here, only ordinary civilians. All apartments were heavily affected.
At 12:15 a.m., we heard loud noises. I asked my mother to step back from the windows. Suddenly, the house shook and we felt an explosion. All windows broke. We asked for help. This is a tragic reality.
The aggression caused significant damage to private property in the heavily populated Kfar Susa quarter in Damascus. Apartments, balconies, and walls collapsed, and nearby cars were affected. Syria's ancient citadel in Old Damascus was also hit. Analysts say Israel's intention for these attacks is to keep Syria in a state of instability.
For 10 years, Israel has been adopting the strategy of strategic battles between wars. The aim is to eliminate any chance of a war on Israel through weakening the enemy. Israel wants Syria to stay in a state of war and instability. This aggression in particular comes as more countries are planning to restore relations with Syria, something Israel wants to foil.
Syria's foreign ministry sent a letter to the UN saying the strikes are part of Israel's systematic aggression against civilians, urging punishment for the crimes committed by the regime. The ministry called for necessary measures to end such aggressions, as well as a clear condemnation from the United Nations Security Council. One shock after another. This is how Syrians live every day, not knowing whether they'll be waking up to an earthquake, act of aggression, or a terrorist attack. All they ask is for the international community to wake up and help ease their unprecedented plights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The Rome-based Islamic Center Imam Mahdi has recently published a book on the late Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qassem Soleimani. Titled A God's Fighter, the Italian-language book revolves around General Soleimani's endeavors to defend the oppressed people, a man, quote, driven by an unshakable faith in God. The book is a collection of messages, thoughts, and letters by General Soleimani, a project that has been supported by all the members of the Imam Mahdi Center.
Who did General Soleimani fight for? By publishing this book, we wanted to shed a light on a man who was always described as an anti-something. Yes, he was against Zionism, he fought against Daesh, but he did all that for God, and that's why we call him a God's fighter in our book. This project intends to fill a void in Italy, as for far too long, all accounts on General Soleimani have distorted his true image.
In 2020, 40 days after U.S. assassination of Major General Qassem Soleimani, hundreds of his posters were hung across many Italian cities. Initiatives to honor the slain Iranian military officer were held in Rome and Milan.
Imam Mahdi Center's book on Soleimani also contains speeches by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani on General Soleimani's martyrdom. The publication also contains photos portraying Iran's former top military commander.
Finding good quality photos of Soleimani was a daunting task. There are only a few good shots of him around. He was not a poser. He was a humble man and he didn't love to be in the spotlight. My favorite photos are the ones depicting General Soleimani with kids and also his mother.
General Qassem Soleimani, similar to my father, because he caused that I love Islam more and more. He is my hero because he always helped the weak country or a weak Islamic country. I'm proud of him.
The book closes with 20 short stories on the life of General Soleimani, his relationship with his family, and with the late Iraqi anti-terror commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Max Civili, Rome.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of beds and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S., if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance group who are suffering from economic crisis will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Protests about pay and working conditions in both France and the United Kingdom have paralysed both nations. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Trade Union of Junior Doctors in England said on Monday, 20th of February, that tens of thousands of doctors have voted for strike action next month, adding to a series of walkouts by nurses and ambulance workers, putting pressure on an already strained healthcare system. The British Medical Association, the BMA, which represents some 45,000 junior doctors in England, said 98% of those taking part in a ballot had voted in favour of strike action, adding that they will stage a 72-hour walkout next month. The British Medical Association, BMA, did not give a date for the strike. Junior doctors agreed in 2019 to an annual 2% pay rise as part of a four-year deal, but they say that is now inadequate in light of the much higher inflation rate today. The British Medical Association said this vote shows, without a shadow of a doubt, the strength of feeling among most of England's junior doctors. We are frustrated, in despair and angry, and we have voted in our thousands. The British Medical Association describes junior doctors as those who are qualified in clinical training and have up to 8 years' experience working as a hospital doctor or up to 3 years in general practice. They work under the supervision of a senior doctor. Britain's Health Minister Steve Barclay called the vote deeply disappointing. Steve Barclay said in a statement, "I've met with the British Medical Association and other medical unions to discuss what is fair and affordable, as well as wider concerns around conditions and workload. I want to continue discussing how we can make the National Health Service, the NHS, a better place to work for all." According to a recent survey, the British Medical Association says junior doctors have suffered a more than 25% real-term pay cut since 2008, leaving many demoralised and 4 in 10 wanting to leave the profession. Another trade union for doctors, the Hospital Consultants and Specialists Association, said its junior doctor members had also voted to carry out strike action in a separate ballot. That strike on 15th of March involves less than 1,000 staff. The strikes will heap more pressure on Britain's state-funded National Health Service, which is already stretched by staff shortages and record backlogs, and is now experiencing waves of disruptive strike action by healthcare workers. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's government has argued that higher pay rises would only cause more inflation and interest rates and mortgage rates to go up further. More than 10,000 ambulance drivers went on strike on Monday, 20th of February, while the nursing trade union recently announced a fresh 48-hour strike action from 1st of March. The website of Economic Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Tens of thousands of nurses and ambulance drivers across Britain launched a walkout over low pay and working conditions, marking the biggest ever strike action in the history of the National Health Service. The strike by healthcare workers took place on Monday, 20th of February, involving both nursing staff and ambulance workers, and have been striking separately on and off since late last year. The strike action was the most disruptive so far in an already strained healthcare system. Britain is facing a wave of industrial action amid the highest inflation rate and worst cost of living crisis in generations, with strikes crippling public services such as the rail network, postal service, airports and schools. In December, nurses went on strike for the first time in more than a century. Healthcare workers are demanding a pay rise that reflects the worst inflation in Britain in the past four decades, while the government says it cannot afford high increases that match the soaring inflation rate. And even if it could, such monetary increases would further fuel inflation. Britain's Transport Minister Grant Shapps has voiced concern the strikes would put lives at risk, citing a lack of cooperation between the backup services, such as the army, and those workers who are on strike. Sharon Graham, leader of the Unite Union, said on Sunday, 19th of February, she wanted Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to come to the negotiating table, charging the government with lying about ambulance workers. Sharon Graham said, "This government is putting lives at risk." Meanwhile, thousands of ambulance workers represented by the GMB and Unite trade unions launched strike action on Monday in their own pay dispute. Both unions have announced several more days of industrial action. In Wales, nurses and some ambulance workers have called off strikes planned for Monday as they review pay offers from the Welsh Government. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has already called for the bold and radical actions to end the crisis across the National Health Service. Meanwhile, a leading business company has revealed that more than 70% of UK households fear they will be severely hit by the cost of living crisis in the first 6 months of 2023, up from 54% at the end of last year. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. A group of charities have said one in four households regularly runs out of money for essentials, and voters do not believe the government is doing enough to help British families. A survey found nearly 40% of people end the month with no money left, while 24% run out of money for essentials either most months or most days. The assessment by the Together Through This Crisis initiative, whose members are Save the Children, Shelter, Turn to Us, Little Village and 38 Degrees, adds to the growing welter of indicators that persistent double-digit inflation and soaring energy bills are having a widespread impact on British households and may do so at the ballot box. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, released figures on Monday, 20th of February, showing that more than half of renters would not be able to afford an unexpected £850 bill, prompting calls for ministers to unfreeze housing benefit, which is stuck at 2020 levels. Macmillan Cancer Support separately warned that cancer patients were resorting to selling possessions and using loan sharks to make ends meet. In findings it described as heartbreaking, the charity said a third of patients had been buying or eating less food, and 22% had been spending more time in bed to stay warm, while there had been a jump in the number of calls to its helpline about financial issues. The research by the frontline charity signals the widening political risk of the cost of living crisis. According to the survey by Together Through This Crisis, even among the 10 most affluent constituencies in the United Kingdom, 19% of people said they found themselves unable to pay for basic items such as food and energy bills by the end of most months. Matthew McGregor, the chief executive of the charity 38 Degrees, a charity that organises campaigning petitions, said, "This polling paints a bleak picture of the crisis unfolding across the country. Families running out of money to put food on the table and keep kids warm is rapidly becoming our new normal." Overall, 6% of the British people told the charity survey they could not pay for essentials most days, rising to 11% in the most deprived areas of Britain. 67% said the British government was not doing enough to address the cost of living crisis.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding prominent Shiite scholars and thinkers all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Home, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding fuqaha and the Shia mutakallimin of the 8th century Hijra, the author of more than 120 books. He is no one but Hassan ibn Yusuf ibn Mutahhar Hilli, mainly known as Allama Hilli. Allama means polymath. His books are really welcomed by most of the scholars and Shia scholars, and his role in spreading Shia Islam, especially in old Persia, is really outstanding. We'll talk more about this aspect of his life, but let's be more familiar with the early life of Allama Hilli from your tongue. The person who is believed for the first time in the history has been titled as Ayatollah. Okay, Allama Hilli. Okay, who is Allama Hilli, Sayyid Mohsen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Allama Hilli was born in 648 Hijri Qamari in Hilla. And Hilla is a place between the Karbala and Najaf. Mm-hmm. And obviously, he was amongst the, we can say, mutakallimin, the theologian, the Shia theologian. He was a scholar of the Ilm al-Usul. Obviously, before him, the Akhbariyun were very much famous, but he got famous because of the Usul, following the path of Usuliyun. And obviously, he was a great scholar in the jurisprudence and the logic and philosophy, because he got all those things. And he reached to the level of ijtihad, why he was known as Ayatollah as well.
Yes.
And because of him having the knowledge of multiple, we can say, sciences, he was known as the sign of Allah. Mm-hmm. That a person, you know, because the word, even when we say Allame for yes. the Hilli, Allame is the one who has command over the different sciences.
A polymath. Yes.
So basically, that's why the word Allama is used with mm-hmm. him.
Okay.
And due to this reason, at that time, they used to call him the sign of Allah, that obviously in praise of him, that we haven't seen such a person who is fallible and he has reached to this level. So that's why he was also known as Ayatollah. On the other hand, we can see like Allama Baqir Majlisi and Sheikh Bahai, they had the permission from the students of Allama Hilli, where it was written that he was Ayatollah fil Alameen.
Mm-hmm.
He is the sign of Allah in the worlds.
Okay.
So it shows the rank and the status of this personality, that how big he was and the status that he had. So basically, he has learned the Quran from his father and the other things from his father and his mother's brother. We say like uncle.
That's right.
Because we have specific word in Persian and Urdu, even in the Arabic, for the mother's brother. But when we say in English, it's just uncle. It's uncle.
Yes.
It can be the father's brother or the mother's.
Yes.
So it was basically Muhaqqiq Hilli. We have two Hillis.
Like. Yeah, Muhaqqiq Hilli was his master.
His master, and yes. He was his mother's brother, yes. His uncle, basically.
And after the demise of Muhaqqiq Hilli, most of the students refer to Allama Hilli now.
Yes.
And you know, he was 28 years old.
Yes.
At the very young age, he reached somehow the status of Marja'iyah, Marja'iyatul Am of Shia in the Hilla on that time, one of the most.
And that was even
centers.
Because he was at that rank before that.
Okay.
You know, he was at that point before that, because in some traditions or the historians or scholars, they have mentioned that he became the mujtahid, or he reached to that rank at the age of 13 or 14.
Yes.
But because Muhaqqiq Hilli was there.
Yes.
The students were not going towards this young kid. And they maybe they purposefully has hide this kid from the general public and didn't show.
Okay.
But after Muhaqqiq Hilli, since his age was too young, like 28, 29, so he got famous after him.
Sheikh Rouhani, the exact date of his entrance to Persia is not known, but his role in spreading the Shia Islam in Iran is really famous. What was the exact story?
Yes, there are many famous stories regarding this Allam al-Hilli, rahmatullahi alayhi. So one of them, as you rightly mentioned, his entrance to Iran, to Persia at that time, is this that at that time, Sultan, the King Muhammad Khudabanda, one of the Mongols, king and Salatin in Iran, of course, he was ruling over this area, and he was Sunni. Of course, the Sunni scholars were at that time in his castle with him as the consuls, as the advisors. And of course, when he came to Iran, he had lots of debates, discussion with these Sunni scholars. As a result of these debates with the Sunni scholars, some of them were in the presence of the king, he actually proved the truthfulness of the Tashayyu, Madhhab al-Shia, in front, in the presence of the king, Sultan Muhammad Khudabande. In one of those meetings that was held in the presence of the king, with the presence of many scholars, the Sunni scholars, he proved the truthfulness of this madhab, I mean tashayyu. And then as a result of this debate, the king, Sultan Muhammad Khudabande, converted to tashayyu.
What was his name? Sultan Muhammad Khudabande.
Sultan Muhammad Khudabande.
From beginning, was his name, original name this? Or no, then it was changed?
It was changed because he was Mongol, one of the Mongol kings.
The Ilkhanids.
Yeah, Ilkhanites, yes.
Okay.
And of course, it was this Allama al-Hilli, rahmatullah alayhi, has a very great book on Imam Ali's truthfulness of Khilafah and Imamah, which is called Minhaj al-Karama. If you read Minhaj al-Karama, in that book, Allama al-Hilli proved the authenticity or the, let's say, truthfulness of his imamate based on Quran, ayat and riwayat, and hadith. The traditions and history, and finally the aql. It is a very good book. It is a very nice book, which later was criticized by Ibn Taymiyyah.
That's right.
Ibn Taymiyyah criticized that book and this mazhab of Wahhabi based on that doctrines established by him, opposing to this main and very outstanding work of Allama al-Hilli. There are two more very nice stories about Allama al-Hilli I wanted to mention.
Yes.
This is that based on these narrations or these stories,
yes,
he actually visited or saw the Imam, the 12th Imam.
Imam al-Asr.
Imam al-Asr, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif. It is said about him that once he borrowed a book from one of the Sunni scholars, and he had to copy that book in one single night.
Okay.
So he started to copy that book to write from the text, I mean, himself by his own hand. But at the middle of the night, he got tired, and he did not have any more energy to copy that. And then at the same time, he had to finish the book in one single night. So then he was actually confused what to do. Suddenly he saw a very young man, a beautiful young Sayyid, came to him and asked him that, "I can help you."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Oh, tonight I cannot accept any guests because I have to finish
this book."
Yeah, please go.
Ascribing.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
Book.
I okay. have to finish this. I cannot accept any guests tonight. He said, "So I will help you. I can help you." He said that, "You're so young, it's difficult, this text is difficult, and you have to write it very correctly, exactly, beautifully." And then it is said that he tested him.
Mm-hmm.
Allama al-Hilli tested, asked him any question and asked him to write. First he wrote in a way, then he said, "I can write better than this."
Okay.
Said, "Okay." Said, finally he said that, "Okay, he might, he can write better than me even."
Okay.
And then he left the book for him and said, "Okay, please copy it. I want to had a short nap."
Nap.
Yeah. And then when he woke up, Allama al-Hilli, when he woke up, he saw that, okay, the book was written completely till the end of the book.
Oh.
In the most authentic and perfect way. And then he understood that, okay, this young man was not a normal man. Because
right.
this book was a difficult book and it had lots of technical terms. It is a fiqh book,
yes.
for example. And how could he finish in one single night?
Mm-hmm.
I got tired just, for example, some pages I just,
yes.
I've just written. This is one of these stories that Allama al-Hilli says that it was the
okay.
only the 12th Imam can do this. Otherwise, the other people cannot do it. And the other one is that in one of his journey to Karbala, he was just walking towards Karbala and he saw then a young man, a very scholarly figure.
Okay.
And he started talking with him, asking many difficult questions from that young man. He answered all of the questions that, you know, when a scholar have questions, they're really difficult questions.
Yes.
And when he was asking him, he was answering all the questions. Then finally he asked this question that, young man, great scholar, respected scholar, is it possible to visit or to see the 12th Imam? Then,
stick
in his hand, Allama al-Hilli.
Yes.
It was suddenly fell down.
Mm-hmm.
And then that man, Imam al-Zaman, ajalallahu farajahu al-Sharif, give it back to Allama al-Hilli, hand to hand.
Yes.
He said, "Why isn't it possible? Why the hand of the Imam is right now in your hand?"
Oh.
And then, of course, in this occasion, Imam ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif mentioned him a very important hadith in one of the Shiite sources. He said that you have to refer to that hadith, and then this hukm that you are asking is mentioned in that hadith,
hadith.
That book, for example. It was one of the book of Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi, if I'm not mistaken, in Tahzib,
yes.
I think.
Tahzib. Okay.
And then later when Allama al-Hilli referred to that book, find out the exact hadith, and in commentary on that hadith, he wrote that I was informed of this hadith by the 12th Imam.
Oh, it was written by...
Yeah, it was written by Allama al-Hilli himself that Imam ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif mentioned this hadith, and I was informed of this hadith by the Imam. So this was really nice...
It shows the highest status of Allama al-Hilli.
Yeah, of course,
Allama
al-Hilli, rahmatullahi alayhi.
Okay, that's right. Very good.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
So what about his books, his compilations, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi?
According to himself, Allama al-Hilli has said that he had 57 books that he has obviously he wrote. And obviously the status that he had, obviously we can find some of the other scholars have mentioned that, for example, he had 95 books.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when Allama al-Hilli has wrote about himself, it wasn't completed, the rest of them. So there are different things that were made by Allah or that were written by Allah Mahili. For example, Mukhtalif al-Shi'a, Tazkiratul Fuqaha. In the fiqh, we have Kashful Murad. We have Babi Hadi Ashar, Minhaj al-Karama. In the theology, we have, the book, which is Khulasatul Aqwal. And Jawharun Nadid, one of the, we can say, magnificent books in logic. You know, generally we study logic, but the one who studies Jawharun Nadid, he goes to the next level, to extraordinary level.
Okay.
So basically, these are the books which were written by Allama Hilli. And even in today's time, Kashful Murad has been taught in the Hawza. Kashful Murad is one of the books for the theology, in the theology.
Okay.
And generally, in the Hawza, they teach it at the master level. They don't even teach it at the graduation level.
Oh, because at the primary level, no.
Not at the primary level, we can say like the graduation.
Graduation,
it should be in the master's
advanced
level.
Advanced ones.
It's not under the graduate, postgraduate, for example.
Yes, that's right.
Why? Because you have to learn a lot of things in order to understand this book.
Okay.
So we have Tazkiratul Fuqaha as the fiqhi, Mukhtalifut Shia as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest were in the theology and Khulasatul Aqwal as the Ilm al-Rijal. These were the things which were written by Allama Hilli. And on top of that, it is better to mention about his teacher, because we have mentioned from whom he benefited.
Yes.
Sayyid ibn Taus is one of the teachers, Al-Muhaqqiq Hilli. It was Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi. And we have the name, Yahya bin Sa'id Hilli.
Yes.
And amongst his, students, we have Qutbuddin Razi. These are the famous names that generally people know. Otherwise, there are many students.
Yes.
But obviously, Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin.
Yes.
The son of Allama.
Okay.
Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin is the one who wrote the book Ma'alim.
Yes.
Basically.
Okay.
And he was also one of the greatest scholars.
That's right.
So this is the basically overall introduction, we can say, like of the Allama Hilli.
That's all right. This outstanding man passed away on Muharram 21st, 726, according to the Hijra calendar, at the age of 78. Because in the city of Hilla, because after the demise of Sultan Muhammad Khodabandi, he migrates again back to Hilla and resides over there up until the end of his life. And his body was taken into the holy shrine of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam in the city of Najaf, and he is buried over there today, the visiting place of so many Muslims and Shiite Muslims all across the world. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Sheikh Rouhani.
You're welcome.
For a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Hasan ibn Yusuf ibn Mutahhar al-Hilli, mainly known as Allama al-Hilli. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information on this program and other episodes, visit our website at parstoday.irt. Another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.